John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, when you think about Arab women, you probably don't think about ideas like questioning authority, changing societies, and leading revolutions. Well, stick around, because this hour, I think you may have your consciousness raised a little bit. We're going to be talking with the author of the book Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. My guest is Catherine Zoff. She lived in Syria and Lebanon from 2004 to 2007 while working as a stringer for the New York Times. She also worked in the Times Baghdad Bureau in 2008. Since 2010, she's been a fellow at the New America Foundation. Her work has appeared in the New York Observer, the Chronicle of Higher Education, the New York Times Magazine, and the New Yorker, among other publications. She's a graduate of Princeton University and the London School of Economics. Catherine Zoff, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow, I have multiple pages of questions. And I know I won't get through them all, and so hopefully we can get to the most important ones. And I ask every author this, and it's an obvious question, but I want to know the answer. Why did you write this book?
Well, I went to the Middle East originally as a stinger for the New York Times. So I was a news reporter, and I was like most journalists in the Middle East, mostly reporting on stories of crisis. At that time, it was the war in Iraq and the refugees who were pouring into neighboring countries and terrorism, political upheavals of various kinds. But I came to feel, living in the region, that there were a lot of stories that maybe weren't being told, or maybe that ordinary life was sort of hard to see, maybe for American readers. And so the book just began really as these back of the notebook jottings, these stories that I thought, gosh, it's a shame. There isn't more written about this. If only there were more space, in our news report for these other stories of change in smaller ways.
So, I mean, you've been a Middle East correspondent. You spent a lot of time there, multiple years. You've studied there. You studied Arabic there. You spent a long time in school there, and you talked to a lot of people at ground level. Talk a little bit about the time you spent and the women you encountered during those times. I was particularly curious. I really wanted you to talk about your time going to school in Damascus.
Oh gosh. I went to Damascus for the first time in the summer of 2004, and I enrolled in a it was called the Center for Teaching Arabic to Foreigners, which is a kind of awkward formulation, but it was a time, this is before the civil war in Syria, long before the civil war in Syria, when Damascus was famously a real destination for Arabic students, because it was very inexpensive to live there, and because relatively few Syrians spoke English or other languages, and so there was a lot of forced opportunity to practice. So I found myself, there weren't a lot of Americans. I did know one or two, but there were a lot of Europeans, Iranians, Chechens, people from other parts of the Muslim world, whose native languages weren't Arabic, who wanted to understand Arabic better because of their religious practice, and so it was a really interesting. Place to find yourself, I thought at the time.
And there was one thing, and you alluded to this. There's a considerable portion of the Muslim world for which Arabic is not the native language, and I'm probably going to get this wrong without actually looking it up in the book, but it was something like only 20% of the Muslim world actually are native Arabic speakers. Is that right?
Yes, that's I mean, that's the estimate that I've seen normally. It's about 20%, and so and Arabic is the language of religious observance for Muslims in any country, no matter what their native language. And the Quran is in Arabic. Translations, well, of course, they do exist, are seen as, are often, I would say observant Muslims often look askance at translations. There's a real focus on studying Arabic and on learning Arabic properly so that you can understand the language in which the revelations came.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be
similar to if Christians needed to learn Aramaic in order to read the New Testament.
Yes, that's true. Yes, but translations of the Quran are less accepted, and so there were a lot of my classmates at the University of Damascus were Muslim students who had. Who would become, more observant, perhaps, or some of them were converts, and studying Arabic was really an important first step for them. So I was a little bit unusual in the lower level classes, in that I wasn't a Muslim, but there were others, of course.
Talk a little bit about how your eyes were kind of opened to some of the really big cultural differences that you encountered, particularly as it applies to gender roles within the Arabic culture.
I described this quite a bit in the book. I mean, one of the things that was hardest right at first was the fact that. Men wouldn't look at you directly, or often many men, especially the more observant Muslims, wouldn't look at you directly. And there's a line in the Quran about lowering your gaze, and this applies to both men and women. But coming from a Western background, it sort of emotionally felt like disrespect, or I wasn't really being seen in some way. And of course, it was intended. As the greatest respect, but it took a long time for me to get comfortable with that.
It seems to me like there are a lot of landmines, verbal and cultural, that you might have stepped on. How did you navigate that?
Oh gosh. Do you have a specific example in mind? Because there are, of course, many.
Well, I mean, we have so many preconceived notions in the West about how men and women relate to one another, and those are really, they don't apply. I mean, as I read your book, it was a real eye-opener in terms of things that we kind of take for granted about how men and women interact. In Western Europe and in the United States, that these rules just do not apply, and you can get into trouble in a big hurry by not observing them.
That's very true. You can get into trouble in a big hurry, but I think you can learn to navigate them pretty quickly. I think what's harder is learning to talk about them in a way that is. It is respectful and understanding and sort of will allow for a conversation rather than, I think it's easy to go to the Arab world and to think, gosh, well, this is just wrong, to feel that you're being mistreated or underestimated in various ways. And sometimes that's true, but often it's a lot more complicated. And I think, religion can have a very silencing effect. I think that, that there's a sort of assertion that this is a religious belief, I think sometimes we sort of stop asking questions. And I mm-hmm. tried hard in the book to push against that a little bit to find ways to ask people why they believe the things they believed.
You write about how the job of reporting in the Middle East was actually easier for you as a woman in some ways than it would have been for a man. Why is that?
I think it was. I mean, I think there are some exceptions. I think that being overall you're perhaps taken less seriously, which you know, at the higher levels, if you want to get you know, an interview with you know, the foreign minister in a particular country, I think maybe it hurts you a little bit. But I think that you know, in a very gender segregated society, a woman can speak to both, and that's often not possible for a male reporter. You'll be invited into homes much more quickly, mm-hmm. And that's an enormous advantage. You can talk to children, you know, with their mothers present. I think there are some, you know, certainly some disadvantages, but I think I found that overall it helped me. I wouldn't have been able to write this book as a man.
Mm-hmm. You were able to capture very private, very frank conversations about a variety of topics: sexuality, separation of the sexes, honor killings. The people you talked with were very forthright with you, very honest. How big a risk was that for them? I mean, you were going to publish what they said, after all. And how were you able to gain their trust of the young girls and women that you write about in your book?
Well, I think living there helped a lot, and I think the fact that that many of them knew my reporting. I talk about this a little bit in the book, but at the time I moved to Syria. The internet was you know, first becoming widely available across much of the Middle East, and I think a year or two later, blogging software became available in Arabic, and so it was a time when, for the first time, people were able to read in real time, practically, what was being published in the West, and so this was unnerving a little bit. You know, you would get you know, at the same time a piece of mine was published in the New York Times, you know, a day later it would appear in one of the pan-Arab dailies published in Arabic. And so people knew exactly what you were saying and how you would couch things and how you'd pitched it. And this led to some awkward phone calls. And I think I tried very, very hard to listen to the criticisms and to the comments and the reactions, and I mean, I felt a lot of responsibility to listen to them and continue to engage with them, because I think I was so new in the region, and I mm-hmm. You know, it seemed very possible I'd gotten something you know, half right. So I think that over time you do earn a certain degree of trust, and I think that you know, many of the conversations that you're reading that were recorded in the book were you know, they weren't the first time I spoke to the woman in question. They were maybe the, you know, the fourth or the tenth conversation, and so I think that after you know, if you take you know, a bit of time, you can make it clear to people that you will report exactly what they are saying, and that you'll try your best to report their opinions accurately. And I think, I think it just took some time, but I think once you know, your subjects feel that you're going to do your best by them, mm-hmm. you've really opened a door.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the book Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. My guest is Catherine Zoff, who is the author of this book, and wondering if you have questions for her about her time in the Middle East and what she learned there, questions about women in Arab countries. What is it you want to know about? And we're going to get into more of the details. We've kind of been setting the table, so to speak, for the rest of the program. Want you to participate as well. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back in just a moment with more of our conversation with Catherine Zoff. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking about the book Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. My guest is Catherine Zoff, who has spent a considerable period of time living in and reporting on the Middle East. And she's with me on the phone. You can be as well at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also reach the program via email, talk@WPR.org, or on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Before we go to calls, let's talk about some specific issues. The one that keeps popping up is sexuality, because the way it's looked at in the Middle East and in Arab and Muslim countries is a lot different than how we view it in the West. Let's talk about some of those differences and how extreme they are and how that kind of flavors a lot of the cultural misunderstandings that that can arise.
Okay. I think this is something, a theme that cuts through a number of the chapters. Young women negotiating basically some of the competing pressures they're under, to sort of be attractive and to participate in the modern world and to work, and also a culture that is very, very conservative in these matters, and that prizes virginity until marriage very highly, much more so than we typically do in the U.S. at least. Did you have a specific question about?
There was a thread that kind of ran through a lot of the stories that you tell. I mean, yes, virginity is prized, and yet there's a lot of rape, even rape of girls who would be considered minors. Children in the West.
Yeah. Yes.
And this is not only tolerated. I mean, it seems to be fairly common, but not spoken of.
Well, it's not tolerated exactly. I think you may be thinking about the chapter on the honor killing in Syria, it's a chapter where I describe the story of a young girl who was kidnapped and raped, because she had been raped and kidnapped, she found herself in the hands of the Syrian police, and they realized that because she was no longer a virgin, that she would she was a risk for an honor killing. This is the killing of a girl or a woman who has had some kind of illicit sexual relationship, and unfortunately, rape is often. It's often blamed on the young woman in question. So I wrote about this case, and then I wrote about an effort to protect girls who might be facing a similar risk, and I spent a lot of time at a center that had been built. It was actually part of a juvenile detention center, and. There were efforts to give the girls classes, professional development courses of various kinds, so that they could work after they became adults, after they turned 18 and would leave the center. And I also talked to the directors of the center about efforts to counsel the girls and help them understand what had happened to them. And some of this struck me as very, very harsh. There was a conversation I had with one of the directors of the center about how she had to get through to the girls quickly that they were going to be killed if they left. Because many of the girls, she said that no matter how conservative a family she'd come from, even if there were honor killings in her community that she knew about growing up, a girl could never quite believe that her father or her brother would actually wish to kill her, that these relationships that had previously been very loving were now transformed by this one thing. And she said all of the girls had this dream that they would just go back to their families and explain and be understood. And she described really being very harsh with them and telling them, no, you're going to be killed. We know this, and these are the reasons. And this, honestly, I mean, I was really taken aback by this. I think reading about honor crime from afar, you know, it's easy to think to yourself, gosh, if that were me, I would just run away. I wouldn't give them the chance, or they, you know, but as I came to understand it, none of the girls see it coming. No one sees it coming. No one thinks that it'll be them, no matter how common it is in the society at large.
Mm-hmm. But there was also I wanted to turn the discussion a little bit more toward education, because you also tell the story about a teacher who goes to an expert, a woman who is also an expert in the law, which is something else that's only recently become more common, about what should she do, because there was a case where a family member, an older brother, raped a sister and wanted to know what she should be able to do about it, and if there were laws about it, and how this could be dealt with. And the description of how the family dynamic in the family, the idea was virginity is extremely important, and if it gets out that this young woman isn't a virgin, then her chances of getting married are diminished. That's something that we maybe have a little bit of a problem getting our arms around here.
We have a problem getting our arms around it. So this example that you're discussing came from a piece that I reported for the New Yorker that appeared early last month in early January, and it was the principal of a school in Saudi Arabia had been searching for ways to help girls at her school who had been raped or sexually abused. And I guess I should preface all this by saying that it's by no means clear that it's true that these things are more common in Saudi society or in any Arab society. These, you know, rape and sexual abuse certainly occur in any society, and based on what I've read, I think that they're they happen pretty equally across societies. What is true is that these are societies that are obsessed with privacy and honor, and where these things are not discussed, and where a family that has a daughter who has been raped really feel that they have nowhere to turn. And so that's a huge problem. And in this particular case, the principal of the school went to a law student, one of the first women in Saudi Arabia to study law. Women have only been able to study law. It was less than a decade that they've been allowed to go to law school, and it's been a little over 2 years since women have been allowed to apply for the licenses that allow them to actually practice as lawyers. And she went to a law student and said, you know, well, finally, that there's a I know a woman who's studying law and can tell me the answers to this. And how can I help these girls? These families never want to press charges because they're so afraid of the dishonor. They're afraid that their daughter will be ruined or that the family will be shunned socially. And this young lawyer was able to tell them, well, actually, you can go to court and you can ask the judge to make the proceedings private, and the girl's name won't be known, the family name won't be known, and you can find justice that way. And so that was a case where there was a lack of information, but yes, the young lawyer that I spoke to described this conversation she had with the principal. Apparently the principal had called the mother in. This is the case of a young, very young girl at her school. She was the principal of an elementary school who was the subject of persistent sexual attacks by one of her brothers. And the principal called the mother in and said, you know, I've become aware that this is happening to your daughter, thinking that the mother would be horrified and you know, want to do something to stop it. And the mother said basically, you know, oh, yes, well, I know, but at least he's keeping it in the family. At least it's his sister. At least he's not doing it to a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
And that reaction obviously was appalling to me, but it was also appalling to the young lawyer who was describing this conversation to me. And mm-hmm. and it it shocked her so much that she organized a lecture series about women's rights within Saudi law, so that other women who were perhaps in a similar situation would have better information about what they could do and where they could turn.
Let's take some phone calls. We've got a lot of people who want to ask questions. I've got a whole list of things that I want to get to here, but let's go to Somerset and hear from Heather. Heather, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to go back to one of the first things I heard in your guest comments about men not looking at women in the eyes. Eventually she realized that it was the utmost sign of respect and not a sign of dishonor or being invisible to men, and that there are many things in the Middle Eastern culture that are seen in Western culture as denigrating to women, when in fact they are meant to be the utmost meant to represent the utmost honor and protection of women. And how do we get that across to Western culture, that this is not meant to denigrate or to put women down, but meant to show that we love and respect our women?
I think it's tricky, and I think thank you for your question, Heather. I think we have to tell stories, and we have to tell them in a way that makes it clear, makes the women's perspectives clear, and that shows that these are not intended as disrespect. I just think but it's difficult. I mean, I when I had gone to Syria, I had read lots and lots about the Arab world before I went, and I had heard of this, and I knew that it was meant as respect, but still, like, you know, emotionally at a gut level, when you're raised, in the United States with certain expectations of how you're treated as a woman, it's something that's still a struggle, I think. And so I tried to explain my own struggle with that, you know, in the hopes that it would help readers to understand their reactions, maybe.
Heather, thanks for your call. A line available for you if you'd like to join our discussion at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Let's talk about education, because that's an area where there's been some movement. How are things changing for women in the Middle East in terms of their ability to obtain an education and how that's actually viewed culturally?
I think there's been an enormous shift in education for women, over the last generation, I'm always a little uncomfortable talking about the Arab world as a whole because the specifics are different, country by country and even city by city, but you can look at the Arab world as a whole and see just a tremendous shift in women's education, and the number of women completing high school, and the number of women going to universities, which is now higher than the number of young men, and this is particularly true, and I think I find this fascinating in the most conservative parts of the Arab world, in the Gulf countries, the numbers are even more tilted towards women in education and men perhaps stopping at an earlier age, and there are reasons for that, and not all of those are the kind of great feminist reasons that we might like to see. A number of young women told me that it was a socially acceptable way to delay marriage, that as long as you were in college or you wouldn't face pressure to get married, or maybe you'd your family had in mind someone you didn't especially want to marry, and you could say, well, I decided to go get my master's degree, and that was again a reason to delay. So number of young women mentioned that, and also a number of women mentioned their job prospects. They said that the job market still tends to favor men. This is a region of the world, again, a very different country by country, but overall, where unemployment rates are very high and where men are preferred in jobs. And so pursuing higher education can be just a default, I guess, mm-hmm. where a young man might get a great job offer after only finishing his undergraduate degree.
You have a story in your book about you're at a gathering of young Saudi women, and a lot of them are pursuing degrees in law but have no intention of ever practicing law. And talk a little bit about the gathering itself and what these young women were interested in and what they were talking about and what they represent in that society and how that's different from what we might assume.
Well, this was very interesting because I think that this was I almost didn't pay attention to. I'm ashamed to say now that I almost didn't pay attention at the time to the fact that they were studying law. I asked questions about it, but this was in 2007 and early 2008 that I got to know this group of girls. Really, they were 17 and 18 year olds, all in their first year of college, and many of them were studying law, and it was because it was a new major for women. Law courses for women were brand new. It had only been a couple of years earlier that women were allowed to study law, and so it was something that was kind of exciting and different and new. And most of the 17 and 18 year olds that I interviewed told me that was why they were studying it. They didn't necessarily know if they would work at all afterwards, but it was it was exciting to feel like a pioneer, and to be part of a new department at their college. And I think at the time I wish I'd asked more questions about that then, they were very I have to emphasize they were very young. They were 17 and 18, and I think I let it go, thinking, well, I didn't have very well developed career plans at that age either, and maybe this is as far as the conversation can go.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was 17, I still thought I wanted to be president of the United States. So. There you go. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have more of our conversation with Catherine Zoff and your calls as well. Space for you to get in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, and you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, we're talking about Middle Eastern culture and specifically the changes that are happening for women in the Middle East with the author of the book Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. Catherine Zoff is the author. She is with us on the phone. You can be too. Todd is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Todd, let's go to you next. Hello, Todd.
Good afternoon to your guests. I have a couple of questions. What it seems like you're describing with the treatment of women and girls and children in Arab countries is basically Sharia law, and it's what I understand of it is that right now there are Sharia courts that are already set up in London and in Paris and who knows where else, other cities. And in fact, I know that there's been in Detroit, they're advocating for Sharia law, and I'm not sure they're not actually operating under Sharia law in some sectors of that city. What's disturbing is that we are asked so many times to be tolerant of what happens of these cultures and things, and yet what they do is so is antithetical to anything that we believe and that anything that we teach. But What I'm concerned about is what are we doing to teach people in America what the real meaning of Sharia law is and what it actually means? Because there was a survey that was done not long ago, and I honestly can't cite the name of the surveyor who did it, but the disturbing fact was it came back most like 70% of the young men that were Muslims in America thought that they would prefer to live under Sharia law, and mm-hmm. I thought. Well, of course, it benefits them entirely.
Okay, well, Todd, let's let Catherine respond, and then we'll get another call in here. Catherine?
Well, I don't, thank you, Todd, for your question. To be honest, I've never reported directly on these efforts to bring Sharia courts to, you mentioned London and to cities here in the U.S., but my understanding is that these are courts that are going to be specifically dealing with inheritance issues and issues of perhaps certain other family issues, that they're going to be very, very limited in their powers, and it's going to be basically for members of the Muslim community who wish to pursue issues, questions of inheritance or disputes over certain other family matters in a court that has some background in Islamic law. So I think that they're pretty limited. I don't think that they're really, something that a non-Muslim or even a Muslim who didn't wish to would have to work within.
Mm-hmm.
But I would just say that interpretations of Sharia law just vary enormously across the Arab world and across the Muslim world. So they without knowing specifically the orientation of the judge or the court, it's hard to.
It's an area where there's a great deal of misunderstanding. I think that's pretty safe to say.
Yes,
What role, I want to make sure we get to this before we get to the end of the show. Talk a little bit, and you referenced this in the book, and you've also referenced it in other articles that you've written. Talk about the role of women in what we call the Arab Spring.
Yes. Well, I guess it's easiest to talk about Egypt because this was a country where women had a very visible role, and it's different in each of the countries that experienced a sort of Arab Spring revolution. Women had a very visible role in every country except for Syria and the Syrian revolutions. I think it was in part because they were immediately so dangerous that I think women were a bit less visible, but in Egypt women were very prominent, in Yemen, in Bahrain, and it was incredibly exciting to see, as someone who's covered the region.
Mm-hmm. And then, but you mentioned Egypt because there afterward things were a little different. There had been people who were side by side at the barricades, metaphorically speaking, but afterwards things kind of changed. Talk a little bit about what it was like for women after the uprising, the toppling of the Egyptian government. What happened afterwards?
Well, this was very sad. Yes, there were a number of women who were, and I've written about this, who were subject to forced virginity tests, which was basically, in a country, in a culture that is prizes virginity and sees it as a sort of cornerstone of family honor. It was a way of trying to discredit the political opinions of women, of saying that you aren't really a good Egyptian woman, and therefore what you believe is invalid. But there was also, I think maybe this isn't very well understood in the States, but the government of Hosni Mubarak had actually been, by Egyptian standards, by the standards of the Arab world, had implemented laws that were pretty favorable to women, especially in family law. Women were given better rights in divorces, more rights over child custody, those sorts of things. And a lot of that was rolled back. Actually, there was a real Hosni Mubarak's wife was half British or half Welsh, and she was seen as a sort of a foreign Western influence on on her husband, and many of these laws, which gave better rights to women, were derisively referred to as Suzanne's laws, and this is something that many of the demonstrators, the protesters, wanted to see removed. I think afterward.
I know I'm jumping around here. I'm trying to cover as many things as I can because there's just so much material here. You also wrote about one of the things you write about is the challenge for women who want to study the Quran, because that's not perceived as something a woman should be doing. But there was a secret society in Syria of women who studied the Quran, and it was actually quite large. That's a fascinating story. Could you give us briefly a picture of what that was like and how you interacted with it?
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned Syria, and of course, many things in Syria have changed a great deal, and you know, it's hard to know whether their work has continued through the revolution and through the civil war. But they this group that I described in Syria were a part of a phenomenon that I think you see all over the Arab world. Increasing numbers of girls and women are memorizing the Quran, studying the Quran, learning to interpret from the Quran in their own right, and this is a domain that has been very dominated by men for a long time, and this is something that I think it's not to be underestimated. I think it might look just like a woman getting to know her religion better, and of course it is that. But many of the women that I interviewed told me that it was also a protection for women, that once you really knew Islamic law, once you knew the Quran well, you could never be bullied in the name of Islam. And they described, many of the women described knowing Islamic law, knowing the Quran better than their husbands or their fathers, and having a sort of a new status within the family as a result. And how, for example, if you were viewed as being very strong in your religion, you'd be given opportunities. Say, perhaps your family wouldn't have considered allowing you to go to college or to work outside the home. Now they might. It was something that I had originally gone into it thinking, gosh, is there a new generation of women religious scholars? And yes, there's some of that. There's some women who are becoming teachers or studying Sharia law at university. But for many more women who aren't pursuing those things, this is it's also a form of empowerment. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was fascinating.
Let's get another call in here before we get to the end of the hour. Troy is with us in Ladysmith. Troy, hello.
Yeah, hello. Good afternoon to both of you. I heard you talk about how they love and respect their women, but yet in the same stories that you've told is when women are raped and kids are sexually abused inside their home. They are the ones that take the rap. They get the short end of the stick, if you will, on it. I'm having a hard time understanding the love and respect that they show their women. I was wondering if you could better explain that.
I think that the lack of protections under the laws is a huge problem. These are countries. You know, and again, I want to be careful about speaking about the Arab world as if it's one thing. But in general, these are countries where they have fairly weak traditions of individual rights, where rights are conceived of more as something that a family has or that a clan has. And so, yes, the unfortunate thing is that even though the rates of rape and sexual abuse and these things are probably no greater than ours, frankly, mm-hmm. I there's a problem of data. These are not countries where these figures are widely available, but the best academic work I've seen suggests that these are that there are no more, you know, child rapes, for example, or the incidence of sexual abuse is no higher than it is here, but there really aren't places to go. And this is what caused, and there's a lot of secrecy that surrounds these crimes, and that has a horrendous effects, which we describe in the book.
But there's a line in your book, and I think that one of the things, I guess, as I was reading and thinking about the show, what I'm hoping that we can do here is to find ways that we can do a better job of understanding the cultural gulf, seemingly, that sort of divides us. But there's one thing that you said that really struck me. It was fairly early in the book. The lines that separate the individual from the society to which he or she belongs were drawn differently here, and people were assumed to be responsible to one another in ways that would be difficult to imagine in much of the West. And that really struck me, because one of the things we hear a lot about in our culture is, you know, the rugged individual, and I'm responsible for myself and I'm not responsible to anyone else. But the culture that you describe is one that is very much about what I do affects everyone around me. I'm responsible to them, and they're responsible to me. Would that be a good place for us to start to try to gain a better understanding of what we're talking about here?
I think it's a great question and a great place to start, because I think it's, you know, and I think part of the problem, it's not just the conception of the lack of discussion of individual rights, but it's also the lack of strong public institutions that will guarantee those rights. You know, if you are a young woman or a young man, you know, say you're 15, 16 years old, and your family doesn't want you to go to college, there aren't places that you can turn. There aren't scholarships. There aren't public resources that will help you. All you have, and perhaps, you know, going to college is seems like a frivolous example, but you know, I'll just stick with it, because it's, you know, it's true in dozens of ways. You know, really, your entire ability to achieve your dreams and goals depends on your relationship with your family, and on your relationship, if you're a woman, with your guardian. And so your interests are so bound up in their interests that you can't even, you know, I think it's hard for many women to even conceive of a difference. And that's something that is very hard to see from here, because I think we look at stories that look like women just simply accepting their fate, or accepting a system that we would that we wouldn't accept, and the women would tell you, well yes, but where else would I turn? Yes, if I were in America, sure, but this is where I am, and you know, what am I, one person, going to sort of overthrow this whole system? I mean, I'm just, to give a silly example, you know, when my parents mailed me a package when I lived in Damascus, I couldn't go pick up that package at the post office without usually bribing three different people, or, you know, standing in long lines. It always took, you had to set aside a whole afternoon to do that. There wasn't, I had grown up counting on this publicly accountable institution that would guarantee my rights to get my mail and my packages, you know, in a timely way. And like, even on a very small level, this just wasn't true. And I think that, you know, I think it's hard for us to imagine ourselves into that place. And I think that, you know, it's easy to look from here and think, gosh, well, if they're accepting that, they must be brainwashed. Or, I mean, this is a term I dislike, but I hear a lot. And it's easy for us to, you know, to think that, but, you know, to imagine yourself into a place where, you know, it's just not practical to protest. Who are you going to protest to, and who will hear it, and what after effects will that have?
Well, we need to protest against the fact that we're out of time. Catherine Zoff, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us and for sharing these stories in your book.
Thank you so much, John. I really enjoyed talking to you, and thank you for your questions.
Catherine Zoff is the author of Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World, published by Penguin Press. Thanks so much to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour programming and handling on-air production, and also to Dave Potras, who handled our technical matters this afternoon. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. I'll be back tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.